It is Monday, December 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, representatives of the Afghan Taliban meet with U.S. officials in the United Arab Emirates. A new report for the U.S. Senate says Russia used every major social media platform to help Donald Trump win the 2016 presidential election. And research shows a dramatic drop in the number of Australian sharks. It's all ahead. Peace talks involving U.S. and Taliban officials took place in the United Arab Emirates Monday. The talks were organized by Pakistan. Government officials were not immediately available to discuss details of the meeting. Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan, tells me about what is known about the discussions.
Well, what we understand as of this moment is that the dialogue has concluded in United Arab Emirates, which basically hosted today's negotiation. And the significant thing about this dialogue is that, yes, Pakistan organized it, and especially honoring a request from President Donald Trump, who wrote a letter to Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan earlier this month that he wanted Pakistan to encourage the Taliban to engage in some kind of a constructive dialogue, because we know that U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has been meeting with the Taliban in Qatar since July. But so far, no progress has been achieved, and U.S. believes that Taliban leaders are sheltering in Pakistan, and Pakistan has some kind of an influence over the insurgent fighters and leaders. So the country should push the Taliban to engage in a peace process so that this deadly war in Afghanistan could be brought to an end. And that is why Pakistan was asked to play its role, and Pakistan did manage to bring the Taliban to the table in a way for the first time in 4 years that representatives of the Afghan government were also sitting in the room, although the Taliban just clarified a little while ago in a statement that they directly spoke to the U.S. and they had no engagement with Afghan officials present in the room. And that clarification has been issued because the Taliban has consistently refused to engage in any kind of dialogue with Afghan government or any Afghan internal dialogue, because they have maintained for long that the U.S. and NATO forces have to withdraw from Afghanistan before any intra-Afghan dialogue can take shape in the country and the Taliban would participate in that dialogue. So the bottom line is that it was the first time in 4 years that the Afghan representative, Afghan government representative, Taliban officials were sitting on the table, but the U.S. was trying to convince, what we understand, the Taliban to stop fighting, stop this bloodshed, and try to find a resolution of the conflict through a negotiated or through a peaceful process.
But considering the depth and range of the issues to be decided, one day hardly seems long enough.
That is absolutely right. This is a good point you raised, because for the past 40 years, we have seen this conflict in Afghanistan going on, and that has created so much divisions and so much hatred among even ethnic groups against the Taliban within other ethnicities in Afghanistan that it is very difficult to have some kind of a process in place in the near future where hostilities could be stopped. But it is widely believed that because Taliban fighters who have managed over the last 3 years or 4 years to take control or extend their influence to nearly half of Afghanistan, that if they stop fighting, the rest of the issues of domestic feuds and tribal feuds could be overcome. But it is the Taliban, which is the main force in terms of the insurgency going on in Afghanistan, that is being encouraged and convinced to stop fighting. But the challenges are so daunting that this one meeting would not achieve anything. But once the Taliban agrees to engage in a peace process, the immediate hope is that there will be at least temporary cessation to hostilities in Afghanistan, because so many people have been killed over the past 17 years in Afghanistan. We understand from a recent study that nearly 150,000 people have died since the U.S.-led invasion of the country happened 17 years ago. And even this year, we have seen unprecedented increase in battlefield activities and insurgent attacks, that this could be one of the worst years in 17 years in terms of casualties inflicted both on Afghan government forces and civilians.
Ayaz Gul reporting from Islamabad. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Donald Trump implores the Federal Reserve to forego another interest rate hike. An Indian court sentences a politician to life in prison. U.S. airstrikes in Somalia killed 62 al-Shabaab rebels. And 80 years on, Germany agrees to a one-time payment to the survivors of the Kinder transport. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
Minute. NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft recently completed its 2 billion kilometer, 27-month journey and arrived at its destination, an asteroid named Bennu. From this past August until December, as the spacecraft drew closer to the asteroid, mission operators turned on and pointed three of its science instruments toward it to make the mission's first observations. Scientists say they detected the presence of oxygen-hydrogen bonded molecules called hydroxyls. The scientists say this means that at some point in the asteroid's history, the material that makes up this rocky carbon-rich asteroid interacted with water. While the 492-meter-wide asteroid is too small to contain liquid water itself, scientists say finding the hydroxyls indicates that liquid water was present on Bennu's parent body, which was a much larger asteroid. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Canadian diplomats meet with the second Canadian citizen arrested in China. A draft report prepared for the U.S. Senate and seen by the Washington Post says Russia used every major social media platform to target voters with misinformation to try to get Donald Trump elected president. The Post said Sunday the report was done by Oxford University's Computational Propaganda Project and network analysis firm Graphica. The report says Russians working for a group called the Internet Research Agency began experimenting with social media to influence local elections in 2009 and expanded its operations to U.S. elections in 2013 using Twitter. It gradually added other popular social media sites to its campaign, including YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden joins me here in the studio. Jeff, what is known about Russia's alleged use of social media?
Well, we now have two new reports, one by Oxford University and Graphica, and another one by a firm called New Knowledge, looking at all the data that they were able to get their hands on from the Russian influence efforts going back during the 2016 election. And the takeaway that what they come out with is basically a much broader, wider, comprehensive look at just how big and how detailed the Russian operation was. Officials and experts have said before these reports came out that Russia had a preference for Donald Trump, wanted to see him get elected president. They said that Russia targeted not just conservatives, but also liberals. But what these reports do is show just how extensive that effort is, just how well Russia broke down segments of American society and tried to get them to do different things, often using race as a key component of their driving factors. For example, one of the reports said that over 30 million users, 30 million between 2015 and 2017, shared some of the Internet Research Agency's Facebook and Instagram posts with family and friends, liking them, reacting to them, commenting on them. So a lot of this information was put out there. But it was also broken down. The Russians put out information for conservatives designed to boost the positions and boost support for Donald Trump. But they also targeted especially African Americans, looking at issues like the black culture, community issues, police brutality. They picked up on the Black Lives Matter movement. And they also picked up at the same time on the pro-police, the Blue Lives Matter movement. But what did they do with the African-American community when they targeted them on social media? They tried to get them not to vote. They tried to get people looking at their posts, masquerading as legitimate posts from people, voices from within inside the community, and say, it doesn't matter, don't vote. Be skeptical. Clinton really isn't for you. Whereas with when they targeted conservatives or people they thought might be more likely to support Trump, they tried to motivate them, give them reason to go out to the polls. But all this is,
for instance, perhaps using like abortion or gun rights.
Yeah,
like
gun
that.
Rights, Second Amendment, religious rights. But they also have focused on veterans issues. Even Native American issues have come up as they try to do this. There's been a lot of the abortion issue, of course, and just playing into some of the just pro-Trump or pro-Clinton or anti-Trump, anti-Clinton sentiment to get people motivated to do what the Russians wanted them to do. And it was going on for a long time. They started, as you noted, talking about this, messing with this type of formulation back in 2009. It really got underway in terms of targeting the U.S. in 2013. And interestingly, the reports say it didn't peak with the 2016 presidential election. It actually peaked. Russian activity on social media looking to divide Americans peaked in April 2017, according to these reports, which was around the time that President Donald Trump, ordered the airstrikes against the suspected chemical weapons sites in Syria. And as lawmakers now reacting to these reports acknowledge, including the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which called for these reports, Chairman Richard Burr says these activities have not stopped, and he said it demonstrates how aggressively Russia has sought to divide Americans, especially using race, religion, and ideology. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that we've seen even more recently in the lead up to the 2018 midterm elections. As VOA has reported, the Russians have been campaigning and targeting social media at U.S. military personnel. The reports talk about how they use veteran issues before that. They've targeted, you know, people in the military now, seeding them with disinformation to try to get them to come to a point of view that will be more supportive of Russia, whether now or in the future. And also there's concern because it's not just Russia anymore. Facebook came out with some reports a few months ago saying the Iranians have looked at that too. The Iranians, unlike the Russians though, focus, their efforts have been much more primitive, much more easy to pick out, but also the Iranians so far were targeting liberal voters, were targeting African Americans much more so than the Russians, where the Russians seem to have a very comprehensive view of all of this and a comprehensive approach.
I believe there's also been some discussion that the Chinese might have used some of these resources as well.
There has been concern. The Director of National Intelligence currently, Dan Coats, raised a few months ago how the Chinese have been operating. The difference between the Chinese approach and with the Russian approach, according to most intelligence officials that we've spoken to, is that China is taking a much more long-term approach. They're seeding much more gradually. They're looking at it from a much more sophisticated point of view, because whereas Russia is trying to sow division and chaos right now, the Chinese are trying to manipulate the American system, the political system and the economic system, to their long-term political and economic advantage. So they've been doing it much more gradually, much more subtly, using some of these tools, but not in the same way that the Russians have been.
All right. Thanks very much, Jeff. That's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Canadian diplomats were able to gain access Sunday to the second of two Canadian men detained by China over the past week, a move that followed the December 1st arrest of Huawei Telecom's chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, following an extradition request by the U.S. over alleged sanctions violations. Canadian ambassador to Beijing, John McCallum, met with businessman Michael Spavor. McCallum met with the other detained Canadian diplomat, Michael Kovrig, on Friday. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said his government is trying to find out the conditions under which the two were being held and why they were apprehended. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Friday demanded their release. In an editorial, the state-run Global Times, China accused Canada of crossing a line by helping the U.S. detain an executive of Huawei. It said if Ottawa were to extradite Meng to the U.S., it would certainly be at a cost of a backslide in China-Canada ties. Gordon Holden is a political science professor, and he directs the China Institute at the University of Alberta. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, this legal and diplomatic tug of war with Beijing is a very serious matter for Canada.
China, well, far behind the United States, is our second trading partner. We had great hopes to begin to grow our ties with that extremely important Asian nation. And this is a huge setback for us, both in potentially economic, but certainly in political terms. We're now in a situation where we're being criticized strongly every day in the Chinese press, and accused of kidnapping a Chinese national. It's an entirely negative story. There's not a good side to it for Canada.
Does Canada feel kind of caught between two giants in a trade dispute?
Well, that's exactly where we are. There's an East Indian saying, I think, that says when the elephants fight, it's the grass that gets hurt, and we have that sense right now. We've been very careful to honor our extradition treaty between Canada and the United States, which we're in the process of doing, detaining Ms. Meng on a request from the U.S. Department of Justice, but it's left us very exposed to harsh criticism from China and now actually action in the sense of unfounded, in the Canadian view, arrest of two Canadian nationals in China.
Is there a concern this will impact Canada's economy negatively?
There is a concern. Already there have been one trade mission disrupted, another visit by a Canadian minister canceled. Those are just the visits we know about. I'm sure there are visits we don't know about that have been postponed or under threat, particularly with a political economy such as that of China, where you have the economy very much controlled and impacted by what the government does. That's true everywhere to some extent, but it's especially true in China. That has really worrisome possibilities for us.
The U.S. and Canada on Friday both promised a fair judicial process for Ms. Meng, the Chinese executive, but Beijing says Canada and the U.S. overstepped their authority and that Meng, who was arrested while changing planes in Vancouver, broke no laws.
Well, that will be ultimately, assuming that Canada proceeds with an extradition to the United States, that question of Ms. Meng's guilt or innocence will be determined by a U.S. court. The Canadian part in this extradition process is simply to determine whether, in the view of a Canadian judge, there is sufficient reason to send her to face justice in the United States. Canada and the U.S. are both rule of law countries. China is a bit different, where politics can very much interfere with the judicial process. As a matter of course, where there's a high-profile issue, that puts us really at odds.
Gordon Holden said concerns over the potential for Chinese espionage is already beginning to affect the giant telecom's global reach in countries like the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and Taiwan. Huawei, founded in 1987, is today the centerpiece of China's ambition to transform itself into a technological superpower. It's at the forefront of the lucrative 5G, or fifth-generation cellular mobile communications. According to the Associated Press, Huawei has the biggest corporate research and development budget at $13 billion. Despite the company's insistence, it is employee-owned and operates independently. Holden said there are security concerns in other countries about the use of its equipment for eavesdropping and that is limiting its reach. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Shark numbers along the Queensland coast have declined by more than 90% for some species in the past 5 decades, according to new research that calls for better protection for threatened species in Australian waters. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia has 170 types of sharks out of approximately 440 species globally. Great white and grey nurse sharks already are listed as threatened in Australian waters. Researchers from the University of Queensland and Griffith University have analysed data from shark control programs to gauge changes in populations over the past 5 decades. Nets and baited hooks have been used in Queensland to reduce the risk of attacks on swimmers and surfers. The research teams looked at the number of white, tiger, hammerhead and whaler sharks caught between the early 1960s to 2016. What they found was a shock, according to George Roth from the University of Queensland, who was one of the authors of the study.
The results are quite striking. So what we found over the last 50 years is a dramatic decline in the numbers of apex sharks on the Queensland coastline. So the number of large sharks on our beaches have declined by between 74 and 92%. At the same time, the size of the sharks are also getting smaller. So there are fewer and smaller sharks on Queensland beaches than there were 50 years ago. This includes the globally endangered hammerhead sharks that have declined by up to 92%. And importantly, white sharks that are listed as vulnerable in Australia have shown no sign of recovery, despite protections that have been put in place over 2 decades ago to stop fishing.
Researchers are blaming overfishing for a sharp fall in hammerhead and great white shark populations. They say that the apparent collapse of certain shark species would indicate that the overall health of the oceans is also in decline. They say there should be greater protection for some of nature's greatest scavengers and predators. Scientists insist that factors such as climate change, which is affecting shark numbers, couldn't explain the scale of the decline. Australian states have tried different ways to reduce the risk of shark attacks. Authorities in New South Wales favour a high-tech approach to deter and detect predators, including drones that use artificial intelligence to spot sharks near surfers. In January 2014, the Western Australian government responded to a series of attacks with a controversial catch-and-kill policy. Almost 70 sharks were caught and shot before the strategy was abandoned after a recommendation by environmental officials. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment.
Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.